on those sites. So on to the next chapter. Now, nothing happened after you delivered your opinion.
Quite so. I sent off the opinion thinking, now that I've made this revelation, which surprised me, let alone anybody else, that there was something that could be done, I expected Gallo to be knocking on my door within a week to say, well, let's go. But in fact, absolutely nothing happened. 2 years went by with nothing happening, which I actually failed to understand, and to this day don't quite understand why for 2 years they did absolutely nothing about it. But in the meantime, Rian Malan's article had sort of got things going, and he had linked up with, that's Rian Malan, had linked up with a Johannesburg attorney by the name of Hanra Friedrich, and they had set their mission to try and do something about it, and they were putting together all sorts of semi-contractual claims and heaven knows what else, which I knew to be of no substance at all, having gone through all the contracts myself. But it was like having to sort of sit on my hands, because I knew what the answer was, and I was very tempted at times to pick up the phone and speak to either Rian Malan or Hanro Friedrich and say, look, you're barking up the wrong tree, but there is a way. But obviously I couldn't do that, because I had done an opinion for a client, and it was for the client to decide what, if anything, he was going to do pursuant to that opinion.
That must have been so frustrating.
It was extremely frustrating, because, I mean, it was a very a novel point in law, not only in South Africa but internationally. Although there had been a couple of cases involving this provision I referred to, which is known as the reversionary clause, there had been a couple of cases in the UK which had touched on it, but none of them had approached it from this particular direction. So being a copyright lawyer with a sort of an academic bent, to me it was actually very interesting to make something of this legal point, and nothing was happening for 2 years. So it was extremely frustrating.
I'm sure it must have been. And what was the next thing that happened? How did that shift?
Well, then, out of the blue one day, I had a phone call from one of the people at Gallo saying that he wanted to come and see me without telling me what he wanted to see me about. So I said, fine, and I made an appointment, and he duly arrived. And when I met with him, not only was he there, but he had a whole entourage of about six or seven people, including Rian Malan and Hanra Friedrich and some of the sort of senior people from Gallo. They told me that they had now decided to join forces with Rian Malan and Hanra Friedrich, and the intention was to instruct me to do whatever was necessary. Money was of no consequence, in order to establish the claim of the Linda family to this song, and therefore put them in a position where they could get some income from it. So I said, well, hooray. I mean, this is what I've been waiting for 2 years. And the strategy we decided upon was that we would find a high-profile defendant to sue. We thought we would do it as a test case, because if I wrote an article or made a statement saying, actually, although you don't know it, the Linda family owns all the rights to these songs, it would have meant nothing. Whereas if you could bring a court case against a high-profile defendant and get the court to uphold your claim, well, then that was, you know, it was the secret, the key to success. So we sort of kicked around a few ideas, and eventually we came up with a very ambitious idea that we would sue Walt Disney in London for including the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight, a derivative of our song Booby, without the permission of the family, which is what they should have obtained. And since they hadn't obtained the family's permission as the copyright owner, they were infringing copyright. And so that found favor with my clients, and I was instructed to go ahead and do everything that was necessary to put that into operation. So I started working on it. I contacted very experienced and competent copyright lawyers in the UK, and I told them about the case. They agreed with my view of the law, and we were getting ready and all dressed up to go. But one thing we had to do was we had to actually decide who was going to bring this case. Now, I had initially thought that Gallo should do it, that we should assign whatever was necessary back to Gallo, and Gallo would then sue as the plaintiff. But Gallo said, no, we don't want to be overtly involved in this case, so we've got to come up with another plan. And then I thought, well, I don't want to get too legal technical, but it became necessary to reopen Solomon Linda's estate. He'd been dead for 40 years already. Mm-hmm. And to appoint an executor who would then now have to deal with this, at the time, unknown asset, and he would have to dispose of it in the most opportune way. And we then decided that the executor should be the plaintiff. So we had to find ourselves an executor. And I thought, well, let's keep it close to home. I'll get one of the partners of Spoor & Fisher to act as the executor, and that'll make things practical and easy to work with.
Yes.
Locating the estate was a major issue.
I can imagine. It's now 2002, and you're looking at an estate that was closed in 1962. Someone who died in 1962, and probably
a very simple estate. Yeah, and a black person from Soweto.
Yes.
So we.
And who looked after those estates in those days?
Well, after a bit of investigation through the master of the Supreme Court in Pretoria, who currently handles estates, we found out that the magistrate of Johannesburg was the person who would have handled that estate. So we went to the magistrate and we said, I'm sure you don't know it, but you or your predecessors in 1962 handled the estate of one Solomon Linda. And, of course, he had no conception of it at all and didn't, in fact, even know that magistrates had handled estates in 1962. So he promised to look through all his records, which he did, and was, not surprisingly, unable to find anything. But he did say that a lot of the old records from that sort of time had been shipped off to the archives, and perhaps we might have better luck in the archives. So we trooped off to the state archives and rummaged around there, and lo and behold, we found the file dealing with Solomon Linda's estate going back to 1962.
I mean, that's almost unbelievable.
It was almost unbelievable to find the estate of a black person in 1962. So we got this appointed. We got this, my partner appointed, Hugh Malamdowitz, appointed as an executor, and I was all dressed up and ready to go, and I arranged for an appointment with the Gallo people to say, right, here we are, now we can move.
We've got a cause of action, a plaintiff, a defendant, we can go.
We can go. And I met with them, and at the outset, Gallo said to me, listen, this is all well and good, but we've decided to drop this whole matter. We've funded it up until now, and we'll meet all your bills up until now, but we're out of here, and as far as we're concerned, case closed.
Oh, that's a lawyer's worst nightmare.
Well, it was to me a major letdown of the highest proportions. I mean, I'd been working on this case passionately for by now 3 years, and just when I was getting to the stage where we could move it forward and actually come out into the open, I was told the plug was pulled, and I was told that was it. End of the matter. Thanks very much.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
So effectively, you were left after that meeting in April 2004 with no client and no funding.
No client and no funding.
And you had to explain this to your partners as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, because it was potentially a very high-profile case, a lot of work had been put into it, not only by me, but other people in the firm as well. It's not something you just want to drop like that and in such an unsatisfactory way. I mean, no reason. Oh, in fact, there was a reason given. Gallo said, we're actually Disney's licensees in South Africa, or New Metro, one of our companies in our group, and it's not going to look good for Gallo to be involved in litigation against its own licensor. And I thought to myself, well, that's a pity they didn't think of that 2 years previously.
That would have been helpful.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there it was, looked like the end of the road, and I was extremely disappointed.
I'm sure. So aren't we going to leave you hanging there with no client and no funding and pause for some music? You've brought some music which is unrelated to your story along. Tell us what you've brought for us to listen to.
Well, I actually am quite a big jazz fan, and when I was a teenager in the sort of late 50s, early 60s, of course, Elvis Presley and Cliff Richard and all of these people were around, and all the hit parades were full of their music, and that was the music everyone played. But I came across some jazz music. I knew very little about jazz at the time, but it really caught my fancy, and I got hold of this LP record, the music from the television series Peter Gunn, which, strangely enough, the theme tune Peter Gunn actually made the hit parades as well at that stage. But the music on the then LP was really to my absolute sad liking, and it really got me hooked on jazz. It was the very first exposure I had to jazz, and it's always had a soft place in my heart ever since. So I would like to play some of the music from Peter Gunn.
So let's take a listen to that. Of all this courtroom drama, we have the laid-back sounds of the music from Peter Gunn, an NBC television series from some time back, the music composed and conducted by Henry Mancini, and we heard a track called The Brothers Go to Mothers. I'm Jean Badenhorst. We're on People of Note, and I'm talking to Professor Owen Dean, or more correctly, he's talking to us. Owen is Professor of Intellectual Property Law at the University of Stellenbosch and is with us this evening telling us the amazing story of his pivotal role in the case about copyright attaching to the song that we've come to know as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, in which he took on the mighty Disney Empire for a very worthy, truly South African cause. So, Owen, we left you last. You were without a client and without funding. Now what?
Well, a couple of factors made me think that actually I'm not prepared to just drop this and close my file and put it away. Amongst those factors were that I had met with the family during the whole process, and they were very skeptical and disillusioned. Other people had told them that they were going to earn them a bundle of money and nothing had ever come of it. And when I said the same thing, I could see it in their faces that, well, here we go again. And I had assured them that this time it was for real and that actually we were going to achieve something. So I had that promise in the back of my mind. Secondly, I had put a lot of effort into this case. I had really come to live with it and felt passionate about it and thought it was a really worthy cause to pursue. And I just was really not prepared to just leave it there. So I said to the Gallo people, look, all right, I hear what you say, you're now out of this, but I'm actually going to continue with it. I'm going to find someone else to fund the case, and I'll have to sort of bring in plan B, change things a little bit, because not having a deep pocket client, there's no way I can go and sue Walt Disney in the United Kingdom. So I decided that the way forward was to bring a case in South Africa where the costs would be much lower and I could hopefully get people, advocates and so forth, to act on a pro amica basis or at least on a contingency basis. And I was on my home ground rather than in the UK. I liked the idea of Disney. Disney to me was just the right kind of profile client that we needed to, or not client, a defendant we needed to act against.
It really was sort of a Mighty Mouse sort of situation.
Yeah.
You had this enormous corporate and this poverty-stricken South African family.
Correct. Mm. So I thought, well, let's sue Disney in South Africa. But that presented a bit of a problem because in London, Disney was itself putting on the stage show. Disney was not present in South Africa. They had an agent in South Africa, but Disney Corporation of America was not conducting business in South Africa. And you generally can't sue a foreign corporation in South Africa. You've got to go and sue them at their home base. And, of course, last place I wanted to go and sue Disney was in America. So I had to find some way of enabling the South African court to have jurisdiction over Walt Disney, the American company. And there was a way to do that and write up my own alley in intellectual property. And it is possible to attach items of intellectual property and as a sort of get a pledge over them. And in that way, you can find jurisdiction against a foreign-based corporation. So I knew very well that Disney had hundreds of trademarks registered in South Africa, and trademarks were a good property for attachment. So I decided that the way to find jurisdiction against Disney was to go out and attach all of their South African registered trademarks, as well as the copyright in the movie The Lion King, because it had been released in South Africa. And there is a system for registration of copyright in films in South Africa, and they had registered that film in South Africa. So that problem could be overcome. The perhaps major problem was funding, because, I mean, even though I would hopefully be able to find advocates who would be willing to act on some sort of basis which didn't involve lots of money, and I myself was willing, if necessary, to act for nothing or very small fees. I felt that passionate about it. But we really did need to have someone to fund the case. And now I thought, well, I can go and knock on doors, some of our firm's major clients, and say, look, there is this noble cause that we're pursuing. We need money. Are you willing to finance? And I thought, well, you know, as a sort of a speculative project to be launched in the future, that may not really sound very attractive and may not be a very good proposition. So I decided that the way to overcome that problem was to launch the case without any funding, and then go knock on doors with a ready-made case, something that was tangible, not just some speculative thing that might happen in the future. So I took a deep breath, and I actually launched the case. I was able to enlist the services of two advocates with whom I work very closely, and they were prepared to act on a contingency basis. Didn't seem appropriate under those circumstances that my partner, who'd been appointed as the executor, should remain the executive. Executor, that just seemed a bit too close to home.
Yes, yes.
So I looked around for someone else who could play the role of executor, and I seized upon an accountant who had worked at some stage as the auditor for Spoor & Fisher, but had gone on a different direction, but was still in active practice. And I approached him. His name was Fani Chrysal. And I asked him whether he would be willing to act as the executor for no funding or no fees. And immediately, maybe at the end of the day, there would be some money available, but at this stage, for nothing. And he was prepared to do that. So this band of altruistic do-gooders launched this court case against Walt Disney. And we had to serve the papers on Walt Disney in America, which we did. We got a Los Angeles-based American attorney to serve the papers on Walt Disney. It wasn't that easy to find somebody, because Los Angeles is a small town in that respect, and just about every lawyer in Los Angeles had some or other connection with Walt Disney and weren't prepared to be seen to be acting against Walt Disney. But I found a colleague that I knew from trademark practice, and he was willing to serve the papers on Walt Disney, and the case was then launched. At this stage, all that we had done was to obtain jurisdiction. We
Yes.
then had to launch an action, which we did. We issued the summons, and that too was served on Walt Disney. And in the normal course of events, what would have happened is that there would have been an exchange of pleadings, and then we'd ask for a court date, and maybe 2 years hence the matter would come before the court. So it was likely to be a drawn-out process.
And this would be the whole debate around the copyright, around Mbube and Lion Sleeps, as the second step, as it were.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I had also devised another strategy. I thought that since we're now suing in South Africa, the most we can ask for is the damages that the, an interdict stopping the use of the song in South Africa, and the damages which the family had suffered, or the executor had suffered through misuse of the song in South Africa.
Yes.
So it was all confined to South Africa. Now, in the overall scheme of things, that wasn't going to be a major sum of money from Walt Disney's perspective. So I wanted to up the ante somehow. I wanted to make Disney sit up and take more notice of this case than might have been the case if we were simply dealing with South African damages. So I decided that what we needed to do was launch a propaganda campaign. We needed to create bad publicity for Disney. So Disney, of course, has this sort of goody-goody family image, and I thought to myself, well, they're not going to want to be cast in the role of the villain who are now withholding money from this family in living in poverty in South Africa. And I thought that was a good propaganda issue to throw at Disney. And so we then embarked on a concerted publicity campaign, and we spoke to the BBC and CNN and everybody and told them we were suing Disney, which of course was quite a newsworthy item for them. But then something happened which actually furthered this cause. What Disney decided to do was they decided to bring a court application, a counter application, to set aside the attachment of the trademarks on the grounds that the attachment should never have been granted, which would have been a very good strategy, because if the court had set aside the attachment, then we wouldn't have jurisdiction against Disney and that would be the end of the case.
Yes.
So, but in order to satisfy the court that the attachment was not justified, they had to really show that they hadn't infringed copyright. So in a way, this counter-application which they brought, which was brought on an urgent basis, so everything was truncated into very short periods. Instead of having 3 weeks to file documents, you had 2 days to file documents, that sort of thing, which of course put us under tremendous pressure, and particularly since we didn't at that point have any funding, it was not exactly a pleasant prospect. But it actually created the incentive to go out and find the funding, which we sort of put aside for the time being. And where it played an important role is that it actually helped the publicity campaign, because now suddenly Disney was clearly taking this thing seriously, and they were objecting to their trademarks being attached.
Now, just to put, not to put too fine a point on, these trademarks are Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. I mean, these are all the
well-known
the cereal
cartoon
box
characters.
Creatures.
Yeah,
these were now attached.
We had sort of, in a sense, obtained a lien on all Disney's famous trademarks, and that really riled them. I think that they were more concerned about their trademarks being attached than the fact that they were being accused of copyright infringement. Yeah, we took Mickey Mouse hostage, actually. That's the way we put it. And that became an enormous publicity thing. So it actually played into my hands tremendously from the propaganda war point of view.
Yes.
But meanwhile,
yes,
I had a court case to contend with. So I now thought, now who can we approach for the funding? And Hanro Friedrich, the family's lawyer, had mentioned to me that he had somewhere along the line at an airport bumped into Pello Jordan, who was at the time the Minister of Arts and Culture, and had somehow mentioned this case to him, and Pello Jordan had shown some marginal interest in it. So I thought, well, let's take the bull by the horns. Let's go and talk to the Department of Arts and Culture and persuade them that it was in the national interest that this case should be pursued. And so we went to go and see the Director General of Arts and Culture, and we put our whole case to him. And to my very pleasant surprise, he agreed that the department would fund the litigation. So there I was now. I had a cause of action, I had a case going, and I had a source of funds, so I was feeling a lot happier.
A little happier, I'm sure,
yeah.
Yes.
But we had to fight this case against Disney, this counterclaim, and they went at it hammer and tongs. So it was not an easy time for me. And we had this exchange of affidavits and things, and then the big day arrived at the court, and the case was argued, and I had quite a good feeling listening to the hearing. And by this stage, I was really feeling pretty hammered. I had gone through a lot, and I decided I need to go and break away and get away from it all. And
you must have been living with this night and day now for, what, almost 6 years by this time?
Yeah, and I then decided to went off to a game reserve, Madikwe, and I thought that was the best place to recharge my batteries. And while I was there in the game reserve, the judgment was handed down, and happily the court threw out Disney's counterclaim, which was a very important result, because firstly it showed that the court believed that we did have an arguable case, and it dealt within a very short space of time with all the major issues. And so the trial became, I won't say a sideshow, but I mean a lot of the issues had already been decided, which would come up in the trial. And obviously, having got a successful judgment, we really went to town on the publicity. And that created really quite a lot of international interest campaign. And eventually, we achieved what I considered was a very satisfactory settlement, because we got a lump sum payment for past damages, an ongoing royalty into the future, and acknowledgement that Solomon Linde was actually the real composer of The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And moreover, the monetary payments would operate worldwide, not only Commonwealth-wide, which is where we had rights, but worldwide. So even in countries which weren't members of the Commonwealth, notably the United States, the royalty payments would cover all of those territories. So in effect, with a little South African case, we were able to negotiate a worldwide settlement with royalties to flow to the family from wherever the song was used anywhere in the world. So I thought that was a fairly favorable outcome.
That's a fairy tale outcome. That really is, isn't it? It just shows when the might of the propaganda machine, what can be achieved. Oh, and I'm sure our listeners have been as enthralled by your story as I have. Thank you so much for joining us and taking us on that very dramatic and entertaining roller coaster ride. And we're going to play out with another of your favorite pieces of music. Tell us what that's going to be.
Well, this is a piece called Cavatina. It's a guitar piece, which is really probably my favorite piece of classical music. And I think it's probably a suitable note on which to end. And I just want to thank you for this entertaining hour I've spent. It's been quite interesting for me to relive this whole experience in much more pleasant surroundings than it was enacted in the first place.
Owen, thank you so much for joining us. My guest this evening on People of Note has been Professor Owen Dean, Professor of Intellectual Property Law at the University of Stellenbosch. You can find a full review of Owen's ebook, Awakening the Lion, by searching IP Stell, that's one word, IPSTELL, on Google. There you'll find interesting links, background material, recordings of the songs themselves, old photographs, and much more. You can find the ebook for sale on the Kalahari and Leisure Books sites. From me, Jean Badenhorst, thank you for your company, and good night.